when I have failed, I've been able to learn from that and learn more about myself. Whereas I think if I'd have gone through success after success after success, maybe would have ended up slightly different to who I am now. It's important that we always remember our purpose. It's really important that we also have a bit of fun. Operational effectiveness, absolutely critical to defence, but where you create an environment where people want to be there, that are proud of what they do, proud of what they deliver for defence, and perpetually learn. It's about that individual that's just joined, that's a year in, and that we give them the opportunity to develop themselves and become the best person that they can be. Developing our future leaders, looking at how we could become better for tomorrow, but also right here today.
Sarah Catterall is the Command Sergeant Major of Strategic Command, a role she sums up as courier, thermometer, and translator. Sarah uses her position to shape culture, boost operational effectiveness, and make the force more cognitively agile. Strategic Command is often unseen, home to fascinating capabilities and extraordinary people delivering impact behind the scenes. Sarah knows that to create truly effective teams, people need to feel safe and heard. We talked about having courageous conversations, unlocking critical thinking, and how to secure strategic advantage through people. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Sarah.
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the Command Sergeant Major or the Command Warrant Officer, Command Senior Enlisted Leader, whatever you want to call us. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what the role is. So for me, it's that we look at culture, we shape our culture, we use our power and position in order to have those conversations that hopefully shift our culture to make us more inclusive, operationally more effective, and cognitively more intelligent when we do that.
I'm guessing that the position that you have is a pivotal one in that you are sitting at the fulcrum of the whole of the command, and you have access to everyone across that, from the senior leadership all the way across all ranks. Is that right?
Yes. So we are classed as advisors. I'd say that we advise our most senior leadership, and I have many mistresses and masters that I go to bring them information or to ask their advice or to give them my view. But I also engage with the force and take that commander vision, convert it into simplistic terms in the way that I'd understand, and talk about that.
Some people won't know what strategic command is. It feels to me like it's the quiet cousin of the frontline commands of the Army, Navy and Air Force. But you're an amazing organisation that has a huge range of capabilities doing fascinating and interesting things. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. So we're the unseen, I would say. We naturally integrate defence. So we use things like our defence medical services, defence intelligence, cyber, digital. We use those functions and integrate through defence so we can deliver together better and stronger.
Strategic Command talks about sharpening defence's edge. Is that right?
It is. And that's because our people are extraordinary. And the things that they do are unseen. When you think about intelligence, for example, intelligence preparation of the battle space, every operation is driven by what the intelligence picture looks like. But you won't hear about that. You'll see the shiny aircraft, the shiny tank, if tanks are shiny. Whereas what we do is bring a layer of capability through our people to make us better. So we have a broad range of people that work in Strategic Command, and we try and be one family, one organisation delivering on behalf of defence.
You're in the RAF, but have you worked in Strategic Command yourself in the past?
I have. So I'm intelligence by background. So I've dipped in and out of what became Strategic Command. I've worked when we were Joint Force Command. I've worked at PGHQ. So, I've worked in and out of what's now Strategic Command all of my career.
I wondered, why is it you joined the Royal Air Force in the first place? Can we delve into why you joined the RAF?
I often talk about why I stayed rather than why I joined. So why I joined is a tale that probably many people have, in that I needed a job and I needed somewhere to live. I joined because I'd been made redundant from Edenvale Chillserv, that used to do ski yogurts. I'd not done very well in my exams. I was from a small northeastern town. So I joined because I needed a job. So my older brother was already in the Air Force. I'd gone to one of his summer balls and had a blast. So I was like, hey, look at that place. I'll go do that. And my dad was in the Navy. I was really fortunate and really blessed in the leadership that was around me. I remember my sergeant, Sergeant France. Everyone called him Frenchie. Mm-hmm. He was amazing. And I was I was a gobshite. And one day he kind of took me aside and said to me, listen, Cattrall, stop pushing against the machine. Use your intellect and influence where you can. He didn't say it in those polite terms. He put me on the straight and narrow. That investment, not the telling off, but that investment, that value, that understanding was really important for me when I was younger. And that continues to be really important to me as I've gone through. When we look at recruitment, when we look at retention, even more importantly, we have to look beyond money and have to look at what else service gives us. And it gives us a sense of belonging when we get it right. It gives us a job that is extraordinary when people understand their purpose. It gives us a team that work together and have fun together. And it gives us the ability to develop ourselves. That's why I've stayed, because I've been very blessed.
You talked about the impact of Frenchie, Sergeant France, and you said he was amazing. What was it that made him amazing?
He did listen. It wasn't just a put up and shut up, Cattrall. Mm-hmm. Go and sit yourself down and crack on. He valued me for what I brought to the team. And there's something unquantifiable in that. It's knowing that you can make a difference. People join wanting to make a difference, I think, or stay because of that sense of purpose. When you think about what defence does, protect our nation, sometimes with our lives, that's an amazing job. And people stay when we recognise that job that they're doing.
With the unique composition that Strategic Command has of its people and its capabilities, does that make it quite different in terms of its culture from the single services?
I think so. So I've worked in a couple of different cultures. NATO was my last one. That was, 30 cultures coming together. Joint is different entirely again, because you've got the strength of Army, Navy and Air, civil servants as well, and then you put a layer of academics and contractors on there and industry, and what you get is a big mass of people that have to work together and understand each other. So it's grown my awareness of organisational culture, and it's grown my awareness of how individual everyday actions strengthen organisational culture, regardless of where that individual's from.
And presumably always focused on the operational output that Strategic Command is really at the edge of.
Yes, so it's important that we always remember our purpose, protect our nation and help us prosper. But also it's really important that we also have a bit of fun and enjoy the place that we work. For me, it's twofold almost. So yes, operational effectiveness, absolutely critical to defence, but where you create an environment where people want to be there, that are proud of what they do, proud of what they deliver for defence, and perpetually learn.
And you talk about fun. Quite often, because of the serious nature of the work that's being done, there's a reticence to think about the importance of fun. But paradoxically, I suspect that makes it even more important to take time to have fun. What does that look like for Strategic Command?
By fun, I guess I mean, I'd love to work in an environment where people enjoy coming to work, where they like the people that they work with and feel valued for the job that they deliver. That's very different for every person. But if you create inclusive teams, you create that knowledge and awareness, you give opportunity for learning, What I think you do at a team level is then create an organisational culture that values people and is really good at what it does.
Part of that is knowing your people. Anyone in the army will say, know and understand your people is really a fundamental responsibility of every leader. Quite often, though, we think we know our people, but actually we don't really know. Is that your experience?
It is. I talk about jigsaw pieces that make up every person. I'll give you a clear example. The other day we did an enlisted engagement day. Team of enlisted that created this day, delivered by the enlisted for the enlisted. I didn't tell them how to do it. I just opened doors for them to do it. And then afterwards we went for dinner. And I thought I knew the team. I'd talked to them about what they were trying to do and I'd scratched the surface of who they were. I started talking to some of those people, and like, for example, one of them dressed up as a goblin at weekends and had designed this dragon figure that they were all making. This is a sergeant, you know, 6 foot odd, brilliant at what he does. And I sat there and I was like, you dress up as a goblin? Give me pictorial evidence of this right now. But it really struck me because it made me realise, as much as I'm a listener, not a talker, and I like to find out about people, it made me realise that there's so much more that you can do to find out about people. And it takes almost a daily effort, time and effort, to get to know the people around you.
In order to do that, you have to create the conditions where people feel comfortable to share that they're a goblin at the weekend. I love that. That's brilliant. I'm intrigued to know whether this was for any particular purpose, as an extra in The Hobbit, or...
I think they did like Dungeons and Dragons.
But about creating the conditions is really important to do that, because unless people feel safe, they're not going to talk about some of the things that they might think are slightly unusual. But actually, by knowing that, you get a much better picture of your people and what motivates them.
We talk psychological safety, and I think it's important on creating that environment. It's at a team level that you do that. And then those teams, you know, if you have individual team and organisation, individual action creates organisational culture. Team ethics, team inclusion creates your organisational culture. And so I think it's really important that we drive inclusive behaviours through everything that we do to create psychological safety. So people feel not even responsible, but obligated to give their views. And that awful trite saying, but bring their best person to work, bring their whole selves to work. There's something really important in that.
Not least of all, because whilst you were having this conversation about goblins over pie and chips, it's much more likely now in the future that if there was some operational imperative that needed that voice of Sergeant Goblin, he would feel comfortable giving that view because he's exposed more of himself to you and others. Whereas if he didn't feel that he was comfortable saying something like that, then perhaps he wouldn't give that critical bit of evidence and information needed that was going to unlock the solution to where best to apply the force in an operational environment.
My old commander used to say, you can't surge trust. And you can't, you have to build trust. And when we build trust by getting to know our people, to understanding them and valuing what they bring, not regardless of who they are, but because of who they are, you start to build trust. And when it becomes to that tricky situation where you need that trust, if it's there already, you stand a better chance of winning. And it's why we train together. It's why we exercise together. It's why we put ourselves under harsher conditions. And that means that when it counts, when it's conflict, when it's crisis, we work better together.
Linked to that is something that I've said before, that I in the past have failed to have courageous conversations about things that needed to be said, but that I maybe didn't feel that I could say them. Is that your experience? Or have you always felt that you can have those courageous conversations?
No.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone.
I hope there is somebody out there that thinks I can have a courageous conversation, no drama. I don't think it works like that.
I remember Sim talking about this on her episode, Big Badge Energy, and she talked about how she felt more comfortable having those courageous conversations as she became more experienced and senior in the organization. And I certainly, that was my experience. How do you think we can accelerate people to have those courageous conversations and be safely having those earlier in their careers, rather than having to wait for a particular period of time before they feel they can have the conversation?
How do we encourage confidence? There's a really important element in that when you pair it back to the why. So firstly, why do we need those courageous conversations? Why do we need our enlisted, our most junior enlisted, to bring their voice to the party? Well, because we're in a technical age, and as technology advances, the people that know the best about what they're looking at are those that are doers. So strategic thinking is no longer almost the bastion of officers. What you need is, as an enlisted force that is able to use their own initiative, able to be critical thinkers, able to strategically think about what their decision, what that means. So you need an enlisted force that are developed in order to do that. When it comes to war, when it comes to conflict, that's how it'll be. We have this view that perfect leadership is where, at the apex of leadership, our most senior leader has made a decision, and that cascades beautifully down the force, and everybody just comes to attention and cracks on and does it. Conflict isn't like that. It's messy, isn't it? Yeah. We need our force to be able to have the confidence to have those uncomfortable conversations, those courageous conversations, whether we're at baseline activity, current operations, crisis or conflict, because they're our strategic advantage. It takes trust, but there's a virtuous circle. So a senior leader or a leader decides to empower and trust their enlisted, that junior enlisted, more. The more they empower them and the more they deliver, the more they trust them, and then the more they'll give them in terms of responsibility. The more responsibility they have, the more empowered, the more trusted they'll become. And there's this circle. If you overlay that circle with education and training, what you get is an enlisted force that's strategic thinkers, able to have the confidence to make those decisions, and our strategic advantage if we ever go to conflict.
You talked earlier about how you're a listener. Do you think that that is undervalued, the importance of listening? Do you think that people feel obligated, depending on where they are in the organisation, to talk and add their value rather than listen and learn?
Sometimes. So I'm an introvert, and I know I am. And when I was younger, I didn't know I was. I just didn't feel I fitted into this organisation. Mm-hmm. As I got to know myself a little bit more, I accepted myself a little bit more and recognised that some of that introversion and the attributes it brings with it are good things. I reflect. I'm a big thinker. I get a lot out of people because I sit and listen. The other day, I did a speech at one of our training academies. I followed a load of 1 and 2 stars. At the end of my intervention, the instructor said to me, "That was really great, Sarah, thank you. And it's the first time we've had a debate where the speaker has asked the audience, what do you think?" I thought about that. I kind of took it away and thought, isn't that interesting? Because what's happened is that they've had some senior officers come and give a speech with questions and answers at the end on what they think. And whilst there's learning in there, I think we also maybe missed, what does that mean to me? What do you think? Colin Powell said one of the most important lessons he learned was that a soldier will always see what you do. So your everyday actions are really important. And the reason I say that is because when we talk about our enlisted wanting to develop, how we want our enlisted to have strategic thinking, it's really important that we also ask them, what do you think? As well as demonstrating that clear leadership from the top, because the two come together to make an organisational strong.
I mean, Richard Nugent in the last series, he talked about how he would often say, "I don't know," in order to hear the view and the opinion and the expertise of people in his team. Epictetus, another dead Greek, he said, "We have 2 ears and 1 mouth. We should listen twice as much as we speak." I know one of the previous jobs you've done is working in NATO as a senior enlisted advisor. Can you explain what that is, how that's different from the role you're doing now, and how did you end up doing that?
There's not a lot of difference in it, I'd say. It's about developing organisational culture through the lens of people to make us better in conflict. So it's about looking at our force and finding ways to make us better. I think that we do have a ways to go. When you talk about valuing our people, developing our people, managing our people, giving our enlisted education opportunities, for example, or opportunities to develop, to push outside their comfort zones, all of those should happen through judgment. Sometimes I think they happen through luck.
One of the most important parts of connecting people is to do that at all levels of the leadership organisation. Do you adopt different approaches to be impactful depending on where you are and who you're engaging with?
No, I don't think so. Does leadership have to adapt? Yes. You have a tool bag of leadership that you reach into depending on what environment you're in. Sometimes, you know, I'm not going to be a collaborative leader. If I'm in a situation where I have to make a decision quickly in order to save a life, you don't want me asking, what do you think? So leadership is a toolbox that you reach into. But then I also think that you shouldn't necessarily change who you are depending on who you're talking to. The general gets exactly the same as what Sergeant Goblin does. And that's about being authentic and reliable as a leader and knowing who you are. I think that's a really important part. Does it mean that sometimes I'll exercise diplomacy? Maybe, depending on who I'm talking to and what I need to land. There's elements in that, but I think at the hub of it, you know who you are.
And you talked a bit earlier about how you learnt more about yourself. Did you have to do that journey of discovery on your own, or did you have people that helped you with that process?
I'd say probably I've done it on my own, pretty much. I think failure's been really important in that journey, because in certain elements of life, when I have failed, I've been able to learn from that and learn more about myself. Whereas I think if I'd have gone through success after success after success, maybe would have ended up slightly different to who I am now.
There's a degree of self-awareness there that some may not have. Are you still trying not to fail, but still learning from failure? Or are you finding that's happening less frequently?
I am not as worried about failure. It's not that I'm trying not to fail, because it's inevitable sometimes. But I'm not as worried about it, because I know that it'll be a learning opportunity.
I think when the reward system is hinged very heavily on one mistake, and it can make all the difference between promoting and not promoting, it often results in people being cautious and not being innovative in their approaches for fear of getting it wrong and being judged negatively for it. I was going to talk about and ask you about your motivation. What drives and motivates you?
There's a quote by the Dalai Lama, and it said, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping in a room with a mosquito. And when I'm at my lowest and defence has become frustrating, because some days, you know, you run at a wall to bruise your face for fun. I think about that. And I think the thing that drives me is that I want to make defence better. I want to make our small corner of the world better because of the importance of our purpose. But it's about that individual that's just joined, that's a year in, that we give them the opportunity to develop themselves and become the best person that they can be. It's about those people developing our future leaders, looking at how we could become better for tomorrow, but also, you know, right here today. I think it's incredibly important. And the job is an amazing one.
And it's a bit like thinking about what your leadership action is going to be that's going to make a difference, not just for that person who's reflecting internally about whether they want to stay, but also how they can be better. In Strategic Command, I know that you've got a number of initiatives, but one of them that I'd be keen to learn more about is your Women in Strategic Command Forum. Can you talk about the genesis of that and what you're trying to do with it?
So I am passionate about inclusion. people should be able to be themselves, particularly in the workplace, for both moral and operational reasons. So it was born out of that passion, really. I used to be chair of the RAF Allies organisation, and then as I moved into Strategic Command, I knew I wanted to tailor that. That became about women in the workplace and our lived experience. Sometimes what we have is conformist attitudes. So we come into a workplace and conform. What I'd love us to get to is a place where we are measured because we are different. Mm. And I'm really fortunate in my senior leadership team because I am the difference, but I'm valued because of that. But it's really hard to be the difference sometimes because, you know, sometimes I think, oh, should I say that? Do I need to say that? But actually I do, because I'll be the voice of difference. And I think a lot of women in particular experience that in our workplace. And it's really important that we hear that voice. So my Women in Strategic Command is a forum, really, for looking at ways to build on some of our cultural initiatives within a focused area to make us better.
We talked earlier about knowing your people. This is, I suspect, part of that, knowing and understanding your people, but also recognising that your difference is going to be different from another woman's difference. That might also include talking about things that people don't want to talk about or feel that, oh, it's not the right thing to be talking about, menopause or endometriosis. The absence of those discussions risks people not understanding how to get the best from all of their people.
We were having a workshop for Women in Strategic Command, and actually we were talking about culture. And I had two amazing individuals that came forward and gave me some of their lived experience on endometriosis, actually. And I had an amazing learning experience because I sat there, listened to what they had gone through, and I didn't know what endometriosis was. I hadn't a clue. And then I had to go away and read about it. It's classed as heavy periods, or one of the things that's recommended is a hot water bottle, which is astoundingly bad. What that did was it really made me draw breath, because I thought, we need to get better at this. And we need to get better at having those conversations. And it isn't just women that have to have those conversations. This is about line managers, leaders. It's about inclusive behaviours and how we push out from women supporting women into workplace. So those conversations become very normal.
One of the things that I think many of us don't know is just how long it takes on average for people to be diagnosed with it. It's just under 8 years is the average length of time. They're not feeling able to have the conversation with their line manager for a whole number of reasons, and it comes back to the trust that you talked about earlier. Normalising these conversations or creating the conditions where people can have them is so important.
And I think it's from endometriosis into hormonal health. As the demographic of women increases in service, we have to normalise these conversations. But we also have to be careful that it's not just about women. This is about making us all better. It's about what we all bring to the party. We will make gains. But I also think there's a duality there where we normalise conversations about things like endo, but at the same time, normalise that women can do amazing things in the workplace and bring something different. And through that difference is we become cognitively better.
Let's talk about celebrating success. One of the great things that I think you must have is the opportunity to see and visit lots of different people and to hear about some of these amazing things that they're doing. Some of these things we will never know, I suppose, and I don't think that's what motivates the people who work in your world to do that. Is that something that you see a lot of? Amazing people doing remarkable things?
Courage, resilience, remarkable intellect, initiative, innovative thinking. There are some astounding people that make you feel very grateful that you're part of the organisation that they serve in.
I've talked in the past about how I have imposter syndrome, and I find if I manage it, that works quite well. Do you endure imposter syndrome?
So I think imposter syndrome is really interesting. And I was asked to give a talk on it actually a couple of weeks ago, which was fascinating because there was a room of very young people and they wanted to talk about imposter syndrome. That's what they wanted to do. I thought, okay, have a think about what that means. So it's a phrase that was born from when the demographic of women increased in the workplace. But I do think that actually everybody can and does suffer from it. It's low self-confidence. And I think it's twofold. So the first one is external. Does our organisation enable us to belong? Or does it cause us anxiety? Does it make us feel like we don't quite fit? So we've got a ways to go, I think, cross defence on how we create that culture of inclusivity. And that doesn't mean that it's bad now. It just means that we have to work on being better every day. But then internally, it's about our perception. Imposter syndrome at its worst for me has been really limiting. So I haven't gone for specific jobs because I've thought, I'm not ready for that yet. I'll wait until the next turn of the handle. And as a result, I've probably done myself a disservice. Imposter syndrome can cause lots of things. In me, it causes overwork. It means I'm busy, not productive. I overthink. To ask you a question, if you don't mind, how do you manage it?
Badly. I mean, I wrote a blog about top tips to manage imposter syndrome because quite often people assume that because I'm from the infantry, I can come across as being very confident, that I maybe don't experience it. But I do. And I think a lot of people do. Often there's a reticence to be honest about it because it exposes vulnerability. I mean, I completely recognise your analysis, particularly around the self-limiting aspects of it. One of our previous guests, Tony Harding, talked about how you've got to get out of the comfort zone in order that others can get into theirs. I hadn't thought about this until she said it, and it made me realise actually, and this was in relation to coming into doing this podcast series where I just said I'm not doing it. By doing it, I am, I mean, not just learning so much, but those things that I thought I couldn't do are now things that I can do. And what it does do is it gives you a stepping stone to the next challenge in a way that you perhaps didn't think was attainable before. So thank you for asking the question.
When you think about imposter syndrome, I think attributes can be on a sliding scale. So at the very lowest, it can be limiting. You start comparing yourself to others. You don't do things. You stay inside your comfort zone. If you do step out of it, you get anxiety, etc. As you top up that, almost that graphic equalizer and go to the top, you wouldn't want to be overconfident. You wouldn't want to be arrogant, have no care for others because your view is the best view. So there's a sweet spot, I think, in the middle that you've reached, and that becomes humility rather than underconfidence. It becomes kindness in your approach, collaborative rather than competition. By having imposter syndrome but raising it up and managing it, what you've done is you've become a remarkable podcast host.
Well, thank you. The check's in the post. No, that's really kind of you to say that. I'm not very good when people say nice things about me, so we can edit that out. Richard Nugent, in his episode, talked about getting the balance right between confidence and arrogance. And the key bit, I think, about that is having people around you that are going to tell you, if you haven't got the self-awareness, when you're straying too far one way or t'other. That comes back to the trust in your team, where they can say, OK, feet need to come back down on the ground a wee bit.
And the alternative. So if you're putting yourself down a little bit too much, someone will tell you that you're doing all right.
I love a good quote. Do you have quotes that you turn to? Oh, you quoted the Dalai Lama as well. Do you have other quotes that you turn to?
My favourite quote is by the unbelievably brilliant Dolly Parton. And she says, find out who you are and do it on purpose.
Just brilliant.
I think it's really important to know who you are and then to be proud of that.
Sarah leads by listening and grows by asking, what do you think? Her approach to leadership is rooted in knowing who you are and learning from your mistakes. I loved her phrase about running at a wall to bruise your face for fun. Most of us will have felt this at some point. She's committed to improve defence because she believes so deeply in its purpose. Her passion for inclusion is palpable, captured in one sentence when she said, "I am fortunate in my senior leadership team because I am the difference and I am valued because of that." It's inspiring how she encourages others to be and hear the voice of difference. And I think we can all benefit from those helpful tips on imposter syndrome. What was it that stood out for you? We'd love to hear your thoughts at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.